Herzlich willkommen bei Heilen, Geheimnisse ganzheitlicher Gesundheit.
Hello, this is Dr. Christian Becker with a new episode of our podcast. And who is this? Charok.
Charok Sherpa.
Hello, it's a pleasure.
Yeah, it's a big, lot of pleasure.
Yeah, it's a pleasure to have you on Heilen, which is a German word for healing and the name of our podcast.
Okay.
Could you share with us a glimpse into your early life and what led you to begin your spiritual journey at such a young age?
So I am from the Buddhist tradition, especially the Tibetan Buddhist tradition. And in the Tibetan Buddhist tradition, we have this traditional way of reincarnation or rebirth that happens. And similar to His Holiness the Dalai Lama and Karmapa and Trishir Rinpoche, Lama Zopa Rinpoche, so on and so forth. So everyone comes in the reincarnation sort of thing. So I got introduced to Buddhism at a very young age, maybe around when I was around 2 years old, through the system of reincarnation, recognition. I was recognized by, at that time, the head of the Nyingma tradition of the Tibetan Buddhism, Trishir Rinpoche. And then after that, I got recognized by Kyabje Lama Zopa Rinpoche, and Kyabje Lama Zopa Rinpoche was the one who brought me into the, you know, into the world of spirituality regarding Buddhism.
So let's start very simple. What is a Rinpoche for our listeners? Maybe you can explain that a little bit.
Rinpoche is normally translated as the precious one. But in the systematic way, it's basically to understand that someone who has been a practitioner in the previous life is reborn into another body after the passing of the previous life. There are certain cases where certain Rinpoches actually get reborn even after the, even before the, you know, the predecessor passes away. I mean, there are certain cases. There are other cases where Rinpoches are born into like two or three different bodies. Like, you know, I don't know how it really works, but something like that. But anyway, generally speaking, Rinpoche is regarded as someone who's highly, I mean, everyone, if you just talk about reincarnation, then everyone is reincarnated. There's no one who is not reincarnated. But then regarding when it comes to practice and, you know, all of that, then we talk about reincarnation in the form of someone who has, led and practiced in the path of enlightenment, and therefore reincarnated again in order to proceed or to continue that path.
Can you remember the time, like 2 years old or a little bit older? What happened there?
Well, I really wish I could remember everything right now so that, you know, I get a lot of questions, but I don't recall anything at the moment. There are stories that, you know, that people who have met me in when I was younger do tell me, like, you know, there are stories that I could recognize people, I could remember people, you know, things like that. I could recognize places. But other than that, me myself, I, at the moment right now, I don't really remember anything. But the process was that I had given my mom like a lot of hard time because I sort of like wanted her to take me up to this place called Charok Charok Charok. So she didn't really know where this, when she wasn't really, you know, clear where the, exactly that place was. So she was trying to take me up to Charok, and then on the way up to Charok, I fell asleep, and that's when Kyabje Lama Zopa Rinpoche's sister, whose name is Aningong something, who lives in Lauder right now, she found me and my mom. And, you know, my mom was, you know, was a single parent because my dad had passed away, and she was, you know, up in the Himalayas. She was working as a porter. She had 3-4 kids. So, you know, she had a hard time looking after the youngest one, who would cry every day wanting to, you know, go and explore this other place that she had no idea of. So because of that, Lama Zopa Rinpoche's sister, Aningong something, she actually took me into Laodo, and that's when she actually wrote a letter to Trishir Rinpoche and Lama Zopa Rinpoche, explaining that there's this kid who, you know, who's looking to go up to, you know, Laodo, you know, all of those things. So that's basically, I think, the, you know, the overall story of how I got introduced into spirituality.
And do you remember anything from your former life?
They said I used to remember. I think there was, when I was young, I think there was a, you know, there was quite a connection, because my predecessor, my so-called predecessor, had like, you know, white long beard. So, you know, there are a lot of people who have approached me and said, oh, when you were young, you would like cut up pieces of paper, you know, like pieces of, you know, small paper, and you'd stick it on your, what do you say, your chin. And then also because my predecessor was sort of like blind, so he used to wear black sunglasses, and that was something that I would always put on. I mean, I still have some pictures of that. So I think regarding those, then I think there was some kind of connection. But when you talk about remembering something very clearly and being able to, that one, I can't recall anything right now at the moment.
You're recognized by the 14th Dalai Lama as a Rinpoche. How did this acknowledgement shape your path and also responsibilities from a young age, actually?
So I was recognized by Trishin Rinpoche, who's the head of the Nyingma lineage, because my predecessor was from the Nyingma tradition. And then Lama Zopa Rinpoche took me under his care and wanted to give me the education that I needed. And that was, you know, when it comes to philosophy, Buddhist monastic universities, the Gelugpa tradition had, you know, the best sort of like philosophical approach towards really learning the 84,000 teachings of the Buddha, learning about, you know, the five major texts, so on and so forth. So Rinpoche, Lama Zopa Rinpoche, had brought me from Solukhumbu, where I was born, brought me from Solukhumbu down to Kupan Monastery, which was in Kathmandu, Nepal. And then I think it was around 1998-99, somewhere around that, there was a Kala Chakra initiation by His Holiness in Bodh Gaya. And that's when Rinpoche, took me to Bodh Gaya, and that's the first time I met His Holiness. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was the time.
Mm-hmm. So we met in Kopan, right? Or not in Kopan, we met in Kathmandu, actually.
Yes.
This year, and where you talked about Buddhism, demystifying Buddhism. And maybe you can, and you also talked a little bit about your experience in the monastery in early years, which I found very interesting. But maybe you can talk a little bit about that for our listeners, how to imagine a life there. It would be very interesting.
So one thing, I think a lot of people have this concept of monks to be, you know, meditators, you know, sitting in a lotus position all the time, thinking all the time of deep, deep, deep thoughts, and, you know, just not having anything to do with the general world. But it's a little bit different for that. I would say it's pretty much similar to, you know, any kind of society, any kind of college, other than monks and nuns having their own samaya, which is rules and regulations, vinaya, you know, vinaya, rules and regulations, oaths. Other than that, I would say the system itself runs in a similar way. Right, a monastic system runs in a similar way to a college campus or, you know, a university. One of the things that does help a lot is the mindset. I would say a lot of the people coming into this world, a lot of the people are not taught about emotions. They are not taught about understanding yourselves. They are not taught about really understanding yourself from deep inside, your emotions, your thoughts, your values, your, you know, your, what we say, your connections, right? So these are important things that people learn through experience. You know, you need to learn to get up and become strong. You need to learn to mentally be able to cope with things that, you know, that you are going to face throughout your life, such as, you know, losing those you are, you know, you love, you are very close to, such as, you know, losing things that you have worked your whole life to, you know, to build up. These are, you know, things that happen. These are conditions that happen. We are in samsara, right? So as long as you are in samsara, these things happen. The monastic system...
What does samsara mean? Sorry, interrupting you.
Samsara is a way of explaining the impermanence, right? or the body itself. So in Tibetan, there's a saying, Duje Kowa Jien Pungbo. Duje is things that don't last, that are impermanent, right? Things that as long as you have something that is impermanent, you need to understand that it doesn't last. It's, you know, it's breakable, it's losable, it's, you know, it's degradable, it's, you know, there's going to be a certain time when it's going to disappear. And that's same with the body, right? So our body is samsara because it's degradable. It changes. It grows up, you know, when it's young, it has good skin, it has good hair, it has, you know, looks, everything looks okay. Then you start getting old, the teeth fall out, you know, the hair falls out, the, you know, eyesight gets worse. And then, you know, by the time the mind leaves the body, you know, the body decays and rots. And, you know, if you burn it, it turns to ash. And if you put it into the ground, it turns into dust and food for other beings, right? Insects. So the idea of understanding that the existence is, you know, it's a very short time. And within that short time, you have the ability to find a way to escape that existence. Right, that is what practice is. Samsara is the existence itself. And we say korva as in the wheel of samsara. And the reason we call it wheel is because, you know, we are approaching that same perspective over and over and over and over again. So you're losing one vessel, which is, like I said, the samsara that you are attached to, which is the body you have right now. Then you pass on. Your mind moves on from this body. This body decays and rots and, you know, turns to ashes or whatever. And then mind, you know, flows into another body. And that other body is samsara again. And then it keeps repeating, right? So it's a wheel of samsara.
So there's somehow some hope for people who might be listening here and who are sick and very sick. So after they will die, or the body will die, decays, they will have a new life. Is this what you're saying?
Yes, it's okay. Definitely.
Let's start very simple. Yes. So how can you know that this is the case from your point of view?
So in order to prove past and future lives, it's a little bit hard if you don't have the right kind of logics that you can apply in order to understand past life and future lives. One part of it is faith. So a lot of people believe in past and future lives, right? Christians, they believe in their, you know, if they believe in God, next life you're going to heaven, and that's next life, right? And in Hinduism, in any religion, there is that system where there's a continuum of it, right? You either go to heaven or you go to hell, something like that. But logically, it's all about impermanence, right? As long as you know that something is impermanent, you also know that there is a continuum of it.
Ah, interesting.
There's change, right? So it's similar to the butterfly effect. As long as it's impermanent, then even if you burn a candle, even if the wax melts, it turns back into wax, right? A certain amount of the fire turns into smoke. And there's the continuum, right?
Mm-hmm.
It melts, it turns into smoke. The smoke turns into, you know, certain particles in the air, and then, you know, drifts off, and then becomes a part of the air we breathe, or becomes a part of, you know, the air that falls down with rainwater, so on and so forth. So the continuum is always there. It's like we call it the chain link, right? You know, when chains are linked to each other.
Mm-hmm.
So the continuum is always there. Just like I said, the body, even if the mind is not within the body, you know, the body, if you put it into the ground, you know, the animals eat certain parts of the meat, and those meat become, you know, proteins or whatever it is for the animal to survive or to grow or to become larger. And then, you know, the other things such as nails that are harder to degrade, you know, take some longer time to degrade, but then eventually it degrades. And big turns into dust or sand or whatever it is. So the continuum is always there. Once it turns into dust, then, you know, from that, the nutrients, soil, once it's turned into soil, then the nutrients are picked up by a tree and it goes into the tree and it, you know, it's sucked into becoming a fruit. And then, you know, somehow we consume the fruit and then comes back to us. So the continuum is there. So you need to understand, as long as something is impermanent, there has to be continuum. If there is no continuum, then it cannot be impermanent. It has to be permanent. The only reason we say it's impermanent is because there is a continuum, there's change, right? If something is solid forever, then there's no change, then it cannot be impermanent. So now, second logic would be the mind. Is the mind permanent or impermanent? We say the mind is impermanent because it changes. Thoughts change, right? Mindsets change. When we were a kid, we want to become a movie star, and then we turn into young adults and we want to become a businessman, and you know, we turn into a, you know, adult, and then we want to be, you know, we want to settle down with a family. I don't know what kind of thoughts people have, but as you need to understand that the mind is impermanent. It changes. Thoughts change, keep on changing and changing and changing and changing. So if it's impermanent, like I said, the same logic applies. If it's impermanent, there's continuum. Now that you understand that there's continuum, then the question comes, okay, what about when it leaves the body? There has to be a continuum, right?
Yeah.
Because it's impermanent.
Yeah.
So the same logic comes. Now people say, oh yeah, but you know, it's the body that functions. It's the brain that functions. It's, you know, some people say it's the heart that gives us the essence of a person. Some people say, no, it's the brain. It has nothing to do with an external, you know, something called the mind. It's just the brain. But there are people who are alive who are brain dead, basically, whose brains don't function at all, but they are alive. There are people who have, you know, who have mechanical hearts, and they are human. They're alive. They recognize themselves as Chris, Steve, Charles, whatever his name is, you know, her name is. And then there are people without eyes. So basically, when you go pointing to yourself, you won't find something that is without the body that is, you know, that is the person itself. So you need to consider the existence of the mind, something that is, you know, different, that is totally aside from the body and the existence of it. And that existence being not permanent, but impermanent, and therefore having a continuum. And then when you understand these parts, then you understand that, okay, after a person dies, the mind continues. And then where does the mind go?
Going back to the monastery, having all this wisdom, when you entered the monastery with such a young age, I could imagine that you didn't have this kind of wisdom at this age. How did you develop these insights and thoughts? Can you tell us a little bit about that experience?
Yes. The monastic system that I went to is Serajay Monastery, which is South India, which comes from the lineage of the Nalanda tradition, which was, you know, which taught philosophy of the Buddha in the early times in India. But overall, it teaches the five major topics, which includes Paramita, Madhyamika, Abhidhamma Kosh, you know, Brahmanavatika. So these are the, you know, these are the topics that it includes. These topics are a condensed topic of the 84,000 teachings of the Buddha. Buddha was a very psychological, you know, he was a thinker, a deep thinker. He thought about things. One difference I always tell, there is difference between other religion and Buddhism is Buddha, one of the most touching words that Buddha said is, logical words that Buddha said is, don't apply what I say just because I say it. You need to check it. And Tibetan, there's the word sirshi, which means when you first find gold, you need to confirm that it is real gold, right? You need to, you need to sand it down, you need to filter it, you need to burn it and see if it's real gold or not. And then finally, when you confirm that it's real gold, then you use that gold, right? So, So similar to you checking if gold is real or not, you need to check my words as well, right? If you don't check my words and you just follow blind faithedly, then it's of no use. There's no development. You're not going to get anywhere. Now, most other religions conclude that in the sense of, as long as you have faith, that's good enough. Right? So I think that's one of the biggest differences. coming down to the point when it comes to Buddhism, Buddha himself, because he was such a wonderful philosopher and such a deep thinker, and he tried to prove everything he understood about life logically, not through faith, not through, you know, conquering, not through, you know, what we say, conversion, not through any of that, but through logic. Therefore, the stand of logic is very, very strong. So as long as you are able to, you know, you're able to use your, you know, that's the thing, right? You have this thing called the mind. Yeah, this intuition, this thought process that we can use, the thinking process. And because we have that, we should use that in our benefit. The only way to use it is by actually understanding that you have it and you have the capability to use it, right? If you have an iPhone and you have no idea how to use it, then basically it's just show off. It's basically of no use to you. So similarly, when you have the brain, you have the mind, the brain and the mind together, working together, the mind organ, which is the brain, and the brain itself. Yeah, so similar to the visual organ, the eye being the visual organ that, you know, that stimulates the visual sight. You know, the brain is like the mind organ that sort of stimulates the thought process. So similar to that, you know, when you have that, then you use that, right? Mm-hmm. So I think one of the pinnacle things you study, you need to understand about life is, life doesn't really go the way you wish that it did. Life goes the way you make it go. Yeah, what is the word?
You imagine? Project. You imagine your life?
Mm-hmm. Projection, right?
Projection.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so logic is all about projection, right? You use the right method and the right tools to project the outcome, and then, therefore, the outcome appears to you. Yeah, that's your ability.
So a lot of thinking during your time at the monastery, right? You could also call it meditation. Is this what we need to get these kind of insights to calm down and to understand that there is a continuum of life and hope, that there will be something after this existence? Do we need to think more?
So one of the things that we need to see important in our life is not the small, small things that are around us. People nowadays are so focused on small things around us, and they think that it's so important that it becomes their, you know, their, what we say, the source of everything around, everything that they want, right? So for example, name and fame, that's one thing that people want, and likes on Facebook and likes on Instagram and likes on TikTok or whatever it is. And when you don't get enough likes, and they, you know, they commit suicide, they do all kinds of stupid things just in order to, and then they, even just in order to get those likes, they do stupid things, crazy stupid things. And this is completely a waste of their life, no? If you really think about it. I mean, maybe you go make some money and, you know, become someone everyone knows, but what are you getting out of that? Yeah, it's like us fighting when we were kids, fighting each other for a piece of chocolate. And now that you're grown up and you're wise enough, you think back and you think, why did I do that? Right? Mm-hmm. Why did I bash that other kid's face in just for chocolate? It was stupid. It was dumb. Senseless, useless. So similar to that, you need to understand what is important in your life.
Mm-hmm.
What is really important. Not just important, but what is really important in your life.
Mm-hmm.
Deep insights. I mean, people nowadays, you go nowadays to, you know, around the world, people are confused about, forget about other things. They're confused about themselves also.
How could that happen?
Yeah. In the olden days, people were built to face challenges, right? You were taught to face challenges. You were taught that life is all about facing challenge, learning about facing challenge, and learning from the experience of facing challenges, and then growing out of that, and then becoming someone new. And then you face another challenge, and then you build yourself up with the knowledge and the wisdom and whatever it's around that in order to get up and, you know, come out of it as a stronger person. That's what we learned. Nowadays, it's not about that. It's about weakness, Right? Don't show your weakness. It's not a right? Who do you want to? I mean, come on, people nowadays are even confused about who they are. They don't know what they are called. They don't know what they want to be. Some want to be that. Some want to be, you know. I mean, it's all over the place, right? So I think the important part is not understanding the importance, not understanding your own value, not understanding what we can understand just by processing.
Yeah, and then like sometimes people come to me and say, oh, now I'm sick. And as I'm sick now, for example, they say I have cancer. It's the first time of my life where I can be myself, where I can do the things I want and do something purposeful in my life. They needed to become sick to do something useful in their life. What do you think about that?
Is this exactly.
Yeah.
I mean, that's how the mind processes, exactly like that. Until they don't see the value of things, they consider something else totally useless as important. And then the moment when they see that they don't have the time, they don't have the energy, the amount, the whatever, the time, the value of whatever they're supposed to give value to, then that's when they start to make things, you know, up for themselves. You know, you fought with your husband, you fought with your wife, and then later on, you find, okay, now I only have a few hours to live. You're going back begging for forgiveness and all of that. If that never happened to you. So the value changes based on what you consider. That's what I'm saying, you know. What you consider important as value starts to change. If you consider being alive important, then you start to see meaning in life. What you want to do, what you're supposed to do, what, you know. If you don't see any meaning in life, you are just waiting for life to pass by, then the value is not there, no?
So seeing the value of life, kind of a healing? Like a...
I would say it's a mental exercise, sort of, habituation that you need to build in order to find not just yourself, not just your path, but find value in this bigger picture. Find the bigger picture in all of this, right? You being alive is one thing. You not having enough time to do something that matters to you, that's another thing. And then you find value in not doing anything, that's another thing again. But at the end of the day, what is important to you?
So you left the monastery, I think, in 2019, right? And... Now, you also changed your life from that perspective. What is your, what is your mission of life now? What do you want to do now? Why did you leave the monastery and what do you do now?
So, I mean, of course, right. At the end of the day, there are certain things that are important in life. Not important, but there are certain things that are necessary in life. What is necessary is not what is important, but necessary is something you need to take care of, right? So financial stability is a necessary, right? If you want to, if you want to survive, if you want to be able to live a comfortable life, or if you want to proceed into, you know, fulfilling your dreams or fulfilling whatever it is, or traveling the world or whatever it is, you need to be financially stable. And of course, financial stability is one thing. Now, the second thing is ethics, value in ethics, what is right and what is not right, right? So that's also one reason. And then the third one is, of course, for me, one thing, the third thing was, what is the word? Expectation. When you don't have enough trust in yourself that you would be able to hold on to the expectations of, you know, fulfilling the expectations of others, that's a hard thing to really keep inside. So the expectation that people had over me to, you know, to do this and to do that and to continue with this and continue with that, whereas I'm a very untraditional person. I'd rather stick to logic than to stick with tradition. I'd give up tradition in order to, you know, to support logic. That's the type of person I am. I'm a very logical person. So if someone comes to me and debates and says, okay, this is better than this, even though it's you know, it's our tradition, it's our culture, whatever, I would say yes. So that's the type of person I am. And a system, a monastic system, is very traditionally change, if that makes sense, right? So it's very traditionally held down to the ground. It's very traditionally chained. It's very traditionally monitored. It's very traditionally run. So it's a little bit hard for me to really function in it, in the way that I want to function.
Mm-hmm.
So these are, I mean, of course, there are a lot of other reasons, but these are, I think, I would say one of the main reasons that I you know, offered my ropes back. But I did it, I really thought about it, and I thought well and deep, and I really thought about it. It was a big decision that I made, not just, you know, out of nowhere, but out of contemplating for a long time. So, so that was that.
Okay, and what do you think about healing? How does Buddhist philosophy contribute to healing? What do you think?
Yeah, so the second thing now, after I've disrobed, what I do is I give consultation to people, emotional consultation, because I'm well learned in Buddhist philosophy. Even though I haven't finished all, I mean, in the monastic system, I haven't finished all the studies. I have studied quite in-depthly, and I've done my Rikchung degree, I've done my Parchin, my Madhyamika, my middle way, so all of those are done. So, and I think when it comes to application of Buddhism, not the traditional side, not the faith side, but when it comes to the logical side, I think I'm quite serious about it and in depth as well. When it comes to applying the, you know, practices such as the Four Noble Truths, such as the, you know, the 10 Paramitas, so on and so forth, the 12 Dependent Links, and, you know, so on and so forth. When it comes to these things, these are the basic practices of Buddhism, and I focus a lot on the basics. So anyway, rounding up everything, I do give consultations to people on ways to deal with emotion, because emotion is very closely linked to the mind, perception, concept, views, perspective, and then also your ability to manage your thought, your views, your perspectives, and then also manage your habituation in your mindset, your mental mindset. Mm-hmm. So because I've studied a lot on this, and then I have been, you know, because when you are a Rinpoche, when you are known as a Rinpoche and you go out and you meet people come to you with their problems. So I have been, you know, since quite a young age, I have been, you know, dealing with a lot of people who come to me with issues of their own, whether it be family issues, whether it be, you know, business issues, whether it be. So because, you know, I have been dealing with this for a very long time, this is something that I'm very comfortable in doing. And also because of my background of all the studies that I did regarding Buddhist philosophy, all of the philosophies that I've studied are so applicable when it comes to dealing with those things. Right? Dealing with stress, dealing with anxiety, dealing with mindset, dealing with concepts, dealing with, you know, how to deal with your emotions. And then overall dealing with spiritually, where, you know, when it comes to Buddhism, where is my practice? What am I supposed to think? What is emptiness? What is, you know, renunciation? What is bodhicitta? What is, what is compassion? When it comes to all of that, you know, we have a sort of an in-depth, even if we don't have realization, we do have an in-depth understanding of these things. So it's easier for me to present. And of course, because not saying that I'm really good in English, but with the minimum amount of English that I do have, and I'm able to speak and talk to people about this, I'm able to, it's easier for them to approach me, as well as it's easier for me to give them a bundle of the necessary items that they need in order to deal with whatever problem they have. So, so that's what I do, basically.
So sometimes there are patients with mental issues, but there might be also people with physical health problems, for example, with cancer. How do you think could Buddhist philosophy help them, or thinking help them?
So a lot of my family members have had cancer. A lot of my friends, I know a lot of people. I mean, I have a lot of older people, so I have a lot of people who have passed away from cancer, people who have dealt with cancer. And at the end of the day, when you do have cancer and when you are struggling, I mean, of course, there's an option where whether there's a calculation of options, whether you, you know, if you do chemotherapy, whether how much, you know, what kind of percentage, or, you know, you reach cancer in a stage four, stage, you know, beyond that, then it's a little bit hard. I mean, everyone knows that. There are miracles. You know, I'm not saying don't believe in miracles. There's always miracles in any religion. There's always miracles. So, you know, keep your hopes up. But then when it comes to dealing mentally, it's important to keep yourself juiced up. If you are mentally dead, that means you're physically going to die. There's nothing, you know, there's nothing stopping you from physically dying. So being mentally juiced up is the most important part of it. Right, your experience, even when it comes to death, your experience with death, don't you think your ability to embrace death when death comes in front of you is better than to scream and shout and not wanting to let go and, you know, make it? That seems a little bit harder, right? When you're screaming and shouting and, you know, when you are so attached to everything around you and then you don't want to leave, but you have to leave, that's going to be hard. But then if you learn to embrace death, if you learn to embrace what's coming forward, that's a very beautiful death, right? We are, mm-hmm. And that's something we are able to do. We are able to learn or able to mentally put ourselves in a position where we learn to, you know, to accept things in a very kind, compassionate way.
Mm-hmm.
Not just compassionate to yourself, but compassionate to those around you as well. Because, you know, if you are screaming and shouting and, you know, in so much pain when you're dying, then of course, just imagine those who love you, who are around you and who are seeing this, it's a big pain for them as well.
Is there anything that people could do to prepare themselves for the future? I mean, we all will die, and is there anything we should do now on a daily basis?
There's a lot of practices. Now, of course, there are different levels of practices based on mindset. One of the things that I always say is there's no one method that works for everyone. Every person works in a totally different way. We have different backgrounds. We come from different backgrounds. We, you know, some people get, you know, some people born in a very harsh family. Some people born in a very luxurious family. Some people born in a very poor family. I mean, people come from all kinds of backgrounds. And then, of course, our growing process is also totally different. Some, you know, people grow with so much pamper. Some people grow with so much, you know, discipline. Some people grow with so much, you know, love. So that also differs. So throughout our journey in life, no one person has the same experience. Therefore, no one person has the same kind of mindsets. And therefore, when you show method, there is no one method that works for everyone. That's why mm-hmm. consultation is important. You know, you need to understand yourself in order to figure out the method that works for you.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Some people, you know, when they get massage, they relax. Some people, when they get massage, their body hurts even more. So what are you? Which one are you, right? So I think based on that, what I'm saying is there are a lot of ways to deal with certain kinds of, like you said, when it comes to death, preparing for death. You can work with compassion. You can work with, you know, the things that we have talked just until now. One of the things is past life and future lives. Now, that's also one thing that you can work with. One other thing that we can work with is importance of life. If you feel like you have done everything right, then there's no fear of dying.
Mm-hmm.
That's also one way of thinking, right? Now, if there's a lot of mistakes that you have done, then there's a lot of questions and a lot of doubt and a lot of regrets. And that's what's going to, you know, be keeping you from letting go.
Mm-hmm.
Then also compassion, the same thing when it comes to compassion. I always say, you know, one thing about death is you need to learn to embrace yourself as well. Right? Unless you are able to give yourself the break and say, okay, it's time to let go. We are not going to let go. And that's a very natural instinct of human beings. So you being able to understand yourself and be able to apply patience, love, compassion, generosity, and also, you know, a lot of, in a way, what we say, you know, like a warm hug, you know, to ready yourself. So these things, everything is important here. Just like I said, it depends on the person. So then if you go deeper into Buddhism, then the practice of emptiness, you know, the not the practice of emptiness, but the practice of the view, application of the view of emptiness, that's also a huge thing. Understanding what renunciation is, that's also a huge thing. You start seeing that samsara is one thing that can also help you for some people. You see that this world is full of problems and gears. You might end up being happy to actually, you know, let go of this and maybe start something new. So it's all, like I said, it's all in the concept. It's all how you want to work and what you are willing to embrace that would make the bigger difference in life.
Talking about miracles.
Yes.
You said sometimes there are miracles and you can believe in and there's always hope. Do you think there is any underlying structure of a miracle? Is there anything that people could do to help the miracle to become true? For example, if there would be a patient with a severe disease, is there anything, like there are many healers around the world, is there any underlying same structure they apply to make a miracle true?
Now, that one, I'm not going to go so much into it because miracles involve a lot of different things. And one of the things that miracles involve is karma. Right? And karma, I say it's always in your own hands, right? It's a Buddhist perspective of cause and condition. Karma is nothing other than cause and condition. The cause and condition, it's like I always explain this as the dough, you know, a dough in your own hand. You know, every finger you move creates a small change in the structure of the dough in your hand.
Mm-hmm.
And it's your fingers that change the structure. So similar to that, the karma changes and karma changes. And you are the one who's changing the karma, you know, with your actions, your motivations, your views, your perceptions. That's how karma changes. And every action you take towards, you know, that you're starting to, you know, change the karma a little bit. So whether it be a compilation of karmas from the past that creates this miracle to happen, or whether it's, I mean, for me, it's a little bit hard to believe that someone else comes into your life and creates a miracle. That's a little bit hard for me to believe because in Buddhist philosophy, one of the things is you are your own teacher, right? You are your own guide. You are your own master. I mean, not guide. I mean, guide. Buddha is the guide. But if you want to apply something and if you want to make a change, just saying, oh, Christian, please come into my life and do this, that's not going to change me, right? If I say, okay, Christian, I want six packs, come into my life and pray for me, you know, maybe every day you pray for me and say, okay, pray and say, okay, let him have six packs. That doesn't mean I'm going to, you know, start developing six packs. You can teach me how to, you know, how, what kind of exercises to do in order to get that six packs, but I would initially have to work in order to get the six packs.
Mm-hmm.
So that's life, right? Someone can come and teach you and guide you and, you know, transform you, you know, way of thinking and something like that. But in order to get results, you have to work. You have to do it. You need to, you know, take the step. You need to proceed. Otherwise, you're not going to get anywhere, right? So similarly, when it comes to karma also, it's in your hands. You do all of the bidding. So when it comes to someone saying, I'm going to come and, you know, I'm going to rain on you and something miracle is going to happen. I mean, some people like to believe in these things and some people like to continue, you know, have their life set up in that kind of belief. And I have nothing against it, of course. You know, if you think that is, you know, what you want, go ahead and, you know,
mm-hmm.
follow the, what is it, God being or whatever it is you want to call it. But at the end of the day, I always think there comes a time when you start realizing that you've been following something that is questionable. Now, miracles for me, it's like the possibility. You know the concept of possibility?
Mm-hmm.
If you have a dice of six faces, you know, six-faced dice, the possibility, the percentage of possibility that, you know, one of the faces is going to be up. What is the possibility there, right? If you have a two-sided coin, now the possibility is higher for both of those, right? When you have a six-faced dice, now the possibilities are lower. right? Now you have karma, which has so many possibilities, thousands and thousands of possibilities. Now the chances gets even, right, even lower. So I wouldn't play with that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if it comes and you have the right kind of, like I said, you have the right kind of intention, you have the right kind of action, and then the right kind of path that has brought your actions towards, you know, towards a miracle happening right now to you, then that's great. But other than that, I wouldn't bet on it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, some people use miracle in order to make themselves feel better. Because with miracles comes recognition, right? If a guy comes and says, I mean, if there's two guys in a room, one is just a normal guy who doesn't say anything, and the other guy is a guy who says, oh yeah, I can levitate. Ah, so the difference there is the attention, you know. So the self-grasping attitude, the ego is another thing that plays a lot. And there are a lot of people who play with their own ego and they say, yeah, you know, I met this, I saw this, I, you know, flew here, I did this. But I don't know. It's questionable.
Mm-hmm. So a miracle could be on the level of curing, like curing cancer, which could mean that there is a tumor which resolves to zero. So there is no tumor anymore after the miracle.
Yes, yes.
Or a miracle could also mean healing on a different level, like changing the inner perspective, losing the fear of death
on a
spiritual level,
both miracles,
right?
Yes, yes.
Yeah.
So that's, yeah, yeah.
And talking about this concept of, yeah, different concept of healing, not in terms of curing only, in terms of spiritual healing, mental healing, do you believe there are any practical steps a patient could take?
Yes, definitely.
To heal?
Yes.
What are these steps?
The first thing is the most important part in life you need to understand. The most important part in life is to be happy. Being sick doesn't equal to unhappiness. There are a lot of people who are sick who are very happy.
Mm-hmm.
Right? There are people who don't have two legs, two arms. Or there are people who are blind and are still happy. Maybe not happy with the fact that they are blind, but they live life in a very normal way. They enjoy life. They enjoy what they can. And that's the beauty of life, choices. You need to understand that nothing stops you from living. Maybe your time has gone shorter by 10 years or 20 years. But then, like I said, it's impermanent, it's uncertain. A person who doesn't have cancer doesn't mean he's going to live longer than the person who has cancer. Like, I don't have cancer, but I could die tomorrow. I could even die tonight. There's no other uncertainty, that's the thing. I mean, I know a person who has survived cancer like 3 times and still, you know, doing very well. This is all uncertainty. So why are you putting so much effort and so much worry and so much, you know, unhappiness in something that is so uncertain? That's the truth, right? That's a true fact.
So it's about positive thinking, or?
Positive thinking changes so much things in life. So positive thinking is a must. It's not just positive thinking, but I think it's the logic that you use in order to apply the positive thinking. Like I said, if you start saying, no, you know, you only have 10 days, so why don't you enjoy life now? That's a positive thinking, yes, but it's not a very reasonable positive thinking. You know, maybe that kind of thought can actually destroy you more than help you more, right? But if you underline the fact that, you know, that reality, understanding reality and actually embracing the time that you have, you know, rejoicing for the time that you actually have. Some people even don't have that 10 days that you still have. So in that kind of perspective, now everything changes. No?
Mm-hmm.
So mindset is a big thing. I mean, I know a friend who had blood dialysis, is it? Every 2 weeks he had to go and he had to change his blood. And he was very, very thin and he was weak and he, you know, if you look at him, he looks very pitiful. But then when you see his spirit, the minute he sees us, and we went to the hospital, I mean, to the place to see him. And then when you see him, he gets up and he's happy. And he's, you know, even though he has nothing there, he's pouring juice for you. And he's, you know, thanking you that you're coming. And then when you're talking within your friends and saying, oh, we are going to, you know, go and play something over there. Then he's like, yeah, I also want to go. I also want to play. I also want to participate. And we're like, oh, can you? but the positivity is there. The enjoyment is there. You see, it's that person is alive. Mm-hmm. That's the important part.
People How about pain? How about pain? I mean, there are some people with pain.
Pain, I always think, is a stimulation. There what are do you people mean? Who enjoy pain. There are people who cut themselves and they think that's pleasure. There are people who cut themselves for religious reasons. They slash themselves with knives and stuff like that. And they're okay with it. They're happy with it. There are people who walk on fires believing that that would give them some kind of power in life. There are people who eat fire in order to gain some kind of... And they're okay with it. So mm-hmm. Pain is a stimulation. I mean, you know, not that I have any experience, but women, if you look at women, every month they have their own period thing. And that causes a lot of pain for them. But then, you know, there are people, there are women, I mean, it's because they have to, the experience that they have the first time and the experience they have after 5 years is totally different because, you know, they have sort of like stimulated into understanding what pain is. Now, we couldn't handle that as men if we had to experience that kind of, we wouldn't be able to handle it because that's not something that we are, you know, sort of like mentally in tune to.
So a cancer patient with pain, what should the patient do from your perspective?
Of course. I mean, less pain is better. There are painkillers, pain relief mm-hmm. methods, medical methods that do give you pain relief. And that's a good thing. I'm not going to advise you not to do that. That's, of course, a good thing. The less pain is better. But then having to, if you had no choice but to, you know, go through the pain, then you might as well go through the pain with the courage and the strength that you have within yourself. And giving you courage and strength is, I think, in one way, is about motivating yourself. In another way, is about looking at things from a different perspective. Right? Like I said, you know, people who cut themselves up for, you know, for religious reasons, or people who, I don't know, who kill themselves for religious reasons. For them, it's easier, right? So, in a similar perspective, if you're able to compare that kind of thing, like, you know, compare your cancer, you know, the pain that you experience during cancer to something like, you know, to a person, you know, being burned alive, I don't think the pain level is that high. So, you know, comparing these things keep on happening, right? There are bushfires, there's thousands of animals being, so this is, I think, just as an example and a perspective that you can actually apply.
So change it to perspective. Mm-hmm.
I think these things work. I mean, like I said, okay, every mind works in a different way. So for certain people, you know, distraction is one thing, controlling pain. This is what we do with a lot of small children. You know, when a small child falls down and hits his head, he starts crying, we try to distract that person and the pain starts to go away. Right? So distraction is one thing. We use that method a lot, but not like a child, but we have to apply a similar method of distraction to an elder, you know, to a adult. Then the second one is comparison. The third one is habituation. Like I said, you know, if you are habituated in pain, you know, pain doesn't become a problem. And that's the way that they train military people, soldiers, you know, so on and so forth. It's through what we say to rigorous acceptance or something like that, right? So that, like I said, also comes from the perspective of mentally being ready to, you know, to cope with certain things. When you give yourself the pat on the back and say, okay, you know, I have to go through it, so I'll go through it, you know, I'll try to go through it the best way I can, I think the pain actually goes down a little bit. Rather than someone who's actually afraid of facing it and doesn't want to, you know, even have to experience it, then that person is going to experience more pain. I mean, they have done researches regarding that. Mentally, you know, like prepared. If you are mentally prepared to go to the hospital and take an injection, it's actually less painful than someone who's not mentally prepared and someone who hates the injection. You know, the pain level is totally different. So, yeah.
Okay. So sometimes people, like patients, are told by doctors, oh, now be aware, you get an injection now. And
yeah,
then there are some studies about that, that the pain level actually increases, telling them, oh, you need to be cautious. Now it's getting painful.
Yes.
What you're talking about is like more beforehand, that there could be a possibility of pain and that you cope with it that way, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, if you start thinking, okay, it's one injection, I'm going to take it, I'm going to be done with it, it's only a few seconds, you know, they're actually able to handle it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how a lot of people handle a lot of things that are a little bit painful. Like, you know, when you get an earring, when you get nose ring, when you get an eye ring, I don't know, right? People get all kinds of rings nowadays. You know, some people have their lips poked. So these things are like, it's painful. Yes, everyone knows it's painful, but it's like, you know, you're mentally prepared. Okay, it's a few seconds and then and it's okay for them. So this is a beforehand preparation, mental preparation. And the process is something similar to that, but, you know, at a much higher scale. But then, like I said, if you tell someone who didn't have the time to get ready mentally, physically, and you know, you end up at the doctor, and the doctor says, okay, in 1 minute, I'm going to give you an injection. Now that's just freaking you out. I mean, that you're mentally, you're going to go like, I'm not even ready, right? So it's important to let people know beforehand, and that I think in. Not in all cases, but in most cases, can give the person the right. So even when the doctor, I think one of the things about doctors is doctors have to be very skilled in recognizing people, right? So what type of people you are, it's okay to tell them that, okay, you know, you need to prepare for this. And some people, if they're not in their right mindset and you tell someone, oh, you have cancer, you know, beforehand, you tell them you have cancer and you need to, you know, they're going to go and do something completely stupid.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, your judgment also matters a lot there. So it's, when it comes to preparation, I think, being able to understand the person and then based on the person and the mindset, you give a method that, even if it doesn't work 100%, you know, you get it to work 20%. That's even, I mean, that's still something you should be willing to take when it comes to helping others.
So becoming mentally flexible or preparing the mind for possibilities is key for healing, right?
Yes.
Is there any final advice you would like to give to our listeners?
I think we covered a lot, but I think that's the gist of it. We need to understand ourselves to the point where we are able to put ourselves in our own shoes and see the situation we are in and give us the compliment and the pat on the back. I mean, it's nothing to do with ego. You having self-esteem, you being able to encourage yourself, you being able to give yourself the strength and the energy and the willingness and, you know, all of this, you know, to take one step forward. It's nothing to do with ego. I mean, of course, if something's ego, we actually know that it's ego, right? If you're full of yourself, that's ego. I mean, that's very easily, we can tell it apart very easily. But for a lot of people, they get confused. So don't get confused between those two. I mean, if it's ego, it's ego. If you're thinking about just for your, you know, if you're way over your limit of the praise and all of that, then, you know, it's turning into that part. But basically, what I'm trying to say is you need to find that deep feeling within yourself where you are able to understand yourself. If you have done certain mistakes, you need to build the possibility of forgiving yourself. Not forgiveness from others, but the first thing is forgiving yourself. Giving yourself time to say, yeah, it's okay. It's a mistake. We're human beings. As human beings, we grow, we mature. What is maturity? It's about making mistakes, learning from those mistakes, and coming out and figuring ways to not make those mistakes again. Now, that's maturity, right? And that's what mistakes teach us. So forgiving yourself when it comes to that kind of point. Being kind to yourself when you are, you know, we are so hard on ourselves. We put so much burden. We put more burden than others put. I mean, of course, we always blame others. But at the end of the day, if you really look at your mind, it's always you telling yourself how you are not doing this right and how you are not doing those right and how you are not, you didn't do that right and how you should have done it. And, you know, these are the things that really, really, really get to you rather than you saying, oh, it's my work and it's my household and it's my, I don't know, my wife or my husband or, you know, my money situation. You can give, these are all excuses. And at the end of the day, it's about how you are able to handle it yourself that makes the difference. I mean, there are people who are very poor, who have nothing to, you know, but they're very happy. They live their life in a certain way where, you know, everything's okay. There are people who are very rich and have everything taken care of them and still are in a situation where they are, you know, where they have to pop pills all the time and say, oh, I have this depression and that and this anxiety and this, disorder and that disorder and all kinds of different disorders. So at the end of the day, you need to figure out your own tuning, your own space, your own ability. And you need to be kind to yourself. I think that's an important part. You need to see that the world is not as small as you think it is. You need to see that the heart within you is not really as small as you think it is. And then especially the mind, your capability when it comes to the mind, it's quite wide. And therefore, your ability to love yourself, to show compassion, not just to yourself, but to all sentient beings around you, that's also a very strong strength that you have within yourself. And that's what you need to use in life, Ron. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that makes sense, but yeah, something like that.
Charok, thank you so much. Yes. For taking the time and sharing your wisdom to our audience.
Yeah, thank you for having me on on the podcast.
Have a great time and see you soon.
Das war der Podcast Heilen, Geheimnisse ganzheitlicher Gesundheit. Ein Podcast von MUX Health. Vielen Dank, dass Sie heute dabei waren. Mehr Informationen finden Sie auf der Webseite www.mux.health. Abonnieren Sie diesen Podcast und teilen Sie ihn mit Menschen, die das Thema interessiert oder die davon profitieren. Damit helfen Sie, den Podcast in die Welt zu tragen und noch mehr Menschen auf ihrem Weg zur Heilung zu unterstützen. Über eine positive Bewertung freuen wir uns. Alle Links zur Folge finden Sie in den Shownotes.